Hey everybody, welcome to the In and After Show. It's me, Lindsay Loveridge, and with me is James Beckett.
Man, it's so great to just now arrive for the first time, just 1 second ago and no earlier. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, James. We're actually technically still early. We could have kept shooting the shit for another, 10-ish minutes. For those who are listening to the audio version of this, James's subtitle today is Don Da Don Da Don Da Don. Do you just want to sing it, James?
Don Da 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 Don Don.
Thank you. All right. So in today's podcast, we are going to be discussing Orb and Don Da Don. But also we've got two news items. One is surprisingly wholesome and the other one really sucks. And we're going to talk about both of those. I'll go over to the chat here. Would you rather start with the one that sucks or the one that's cute?
Let's start with the cute. Let's start with something positive.
Chat's got 5 seconds to weigh in.
Come on, chat. Come on, chat. Stand with me here.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, we're going cute. We're going cute, although one of these images, I don't know if it's cute or not. So, the Vatican.
Mm-hmm. Hallowed institution.
Hallowed institution, and at least one anime fan is there because we get
that's true.
Other IP pings on our site every once in a while. I think we found him not that long ago.
I choose to believe that it is the Pope.
You choose to believe that it is the Pope. Yes.
I need to know that the Pope read my reviews of Pop Team Epic and Fruit of Evolution. If I can believe that, then I will die a happy man.
Well, we'll go ahead and give you credit for that because the news is the Vatican has unveiled an official mascot for the holy year 2025. Mm-hmm. I don't know if them introducing a mascot for the year is new or not, but this one is definitely making its rounds because it is very, very cute. Her name is probably Luce, which is the Italian word for light. She is adorable, anime-like, wears a yellow raincoat, has a cross, and has a shepherd's hook. And
muddy boots. I think muddy boots are like a...
I feel like the muddy boots are very important to this design because it lets you know that she's out there spreading the word. She's not just saying it. She's about it, right?
And also, I mean, who of us is free from the metaphorical sin mud on the soles of our boots, which are our souls? I don't know. I had something there. I lost it.
I think I kind of got it, and I'm worse for it. So anyway, showing here on the screen here is Luce, the new mascot. And the internet did what the internet do. And that means immediately started making fan art of her. Now, as James said, this is the PC fan art. It should say that because she looks like a cross between like a Precious Moments character and like a Sanrio mascot, don't you think?
Yes. I mean, look, the first thing I thought when I saw her was no one can ever let the creator of Maiden Abyss know. No one can ever tell him.
Yeah.
I love
yeah.
Maiden Abyss, but I'm just being honest.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you know what would happen to that poor girl in the abyss.
Yeah. She'd do her best and she would have, as the meme says in this image, the power of God and anime on her side.
I mean, it really like they that one is basically just... That's tailor-made. That one was waiting for Luce.
Yes.
To be complete.
Yes. Nanigashi says, so when Satan wants your soul, you give him your shoe.
Yeah. There has to be some kind of myth out there about like Satan stealing your shoes, but then...
There's definitely a myth specifically about stepping on the head of evil, the snake metaphor of like crushing it under your heel. That's in there somewhere. I know that's a...
I gotta say, honestly, I actually love the muddy boots. I think that's a really cute touch. I actually haven't seen anything like that in a mascot before. Like intentional like dirtiness or shabbiness. Like that's very Catholic. So
is it?
It depends on which avenue of Catholicism we're going down. But if we're going down the humility angle,
the
worldly angle, like you said.
Yeah. Yeah, then it definitely fits. One of the other images you sent, is that supposed to be...
I'm assuming it's a demon and or Satan.
Yeah, it says... it says devil?
Oh, yes, there's one more.
Yeah, there's one more. Buddy Jesus going on here.
Buddy Christ.
Buddy Christ, yeah. I really liked this one. as far as the fan art options go.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, I don't know if Lucci canonically skateboards, but she should, you know?
I mean, she's a woman of the people, so.
Yeah.
I mean, and the Catholic Church apparently said the reason for Lucci's existence is to ingratiate the church with them hip young kids and their pop culture animes.
They had to have gone to the one member of the church in Vatican City who reads their website for him. Yeah,
right?
I have to believe that. Like,
what do the kids like? Do they like the Scooby Doo? Do they like the Fred Flintstone? And it's like, no, Your Holiness. They like weird, horny anime. Oh,
yeah. Oh man. So I mean, hopefully, an article with a little more backstory going on there. I hope she gets like a theme song. Little net anime of 5-minute shorts or something. The last overtly Christian anime thing I know of is Superbook, which
I want like a Rankin Bass claymation special, like yeah. The Little Drummer Boy, but with her.
Yeah, make it all look as close to Pingu as possible. Quanti 5 asks, has anyone asked Pope Francis if he's seen Devilman Crybaby? We can't let the Pope see that. That's.
But no, that's the Pope's domain. He has to understand the evil that he's fighting.
I guess that's true. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about being a good Pope. So my opinion is...
I guess it's true. I don't either.
So anyway, that's Luce. Maybe we'll see more of her in the future. I don't know. But people have just been going wild on the internet. So I'm sure if you look her up, you can find a variety of silly images as well as lewd images. So, because it's the internet.
We know what we do around here.
Our second story is not nearly as lighthearted, unfortunately. This has also been picked up over on social media. We have a video that gives you the short, quick version of this on our own social media channels. But in short, Crunchyroll is in hot water because a voice actor and ADR director, in this case David Wald, has made accusations that they have not been giving him his fan mail for the last 5 years. And have specifically been opening it, taking any gifts or things of value sent to him by fans and putting it on what was known as like the employee freebie table. And then employees were just taking it not knowing that it was meant for him. Mm-hmm. And this is something he only recently found out. If you go to his social media, he's been very upfront about how upset he is about this, saying that he should be considered untied to Crunchyroll Funimation. He says that he hasn't received an apology or any kind of response directly from them yet at this point. I will note that we, Anime News Network, have gotten a statement, but he's saying that he has not gotten any direct communication and that he may be pursuing legal avenues about this. So I wanted to talk about that. Before we do, I will read the statement by Crunchyroll. We want to do our due diligence here. They say they are investigating this and they respect the privacy. This is, quote, "We respect the privacy of all of our voice actors and do not intentionally open mail or packages not intended for Crunchyroll. Any fan mail should be sent directly to talent and their management," end quote. That last sentence is sort of interesting because David Wald claims that they were encouraged to have their fan mail sent to the studio. And that last sentence is a new policy that wasn't previously enacted during his time there. Mm-hmm. So that's his take on that. Obviously,
would that have been before the buyout?
This would have started before the buyout. And that's something that I wanted to make sure that we talked about because people get very confused about that because of things that have gotten kind of murky, at least on the face of it, since this buyout. So important things to remember is Sony bought Funimation, bought Crunchyroll. It wasn't Crunchyroll that bought out Funimation. People think Funimation is gone, but that's not truly what happened. Funimation bought Crunchyroll and then rebranded. So the Funimation brand, as far as what things are called, no longer exists. But that doesn't mean everyone at Funimation lost their jobs.
No.
And are gone, and that this is all just people who were at Crunchyroll pre-buyout. This is important because where David was saying this was taking place was in Texas, because that's where the Funimation headquarters is, that's still in operation under the new name, That's where they do all their dubs. It's where the studio is at. That's where the voice actors that are based out of Texas would be going to record. So that's the space where this mail was being sent and then allegedly opened and then redistributed to employees there. Crunchyroll has another headquarters that's like in the San Francisco area. That's the one that people like to rag on for looking like a theme park. If anyone saw those pictures that went around that were basically like Shibuya landmarks, but all inside their offices or whatever. The people who work there and are mostly in that building are not likely to be in any way related to what was going on in Texas.
Yeah.
So I wanted to clarify that because I've seen online people getting pretty mixed up about this. Like they bring up Crunchyroll's past as not a pirating site, but they hosted like fan sub uploads and stuff like that. And they didn't have them all cleared out immediately when they started going legit. And people keep bringing that up as like, they started as criminals, yada, yada. That's a fair criticism, but it's not really relevant to likely the management and everything who could be involved in what Wald is talking about.
I mean, that it's obviously nowhere near as large scale, but that's like ragging on the employees at Facebook for being a bunch of like douchey frat bros that, you know, started that website out of Zuckerberg's like basement. Right.
Yeah.
Like, at this point, it is an entity that employs many, many people. Most of whom, like you said, did not start at Crunchyroll. They were Funimation crew, you know,
yeah.
Especially with this current situation.
Right. And so what David is alleging here is that the stuff that was happening to his mail was going on there prior to the merger entirely and then continued afterwards, which seems to indicate that it carried over or the same people were still present after that happened. Just really disappointing to find out. I feel like this is a horrible look for any kind of company.
Yeah.
Crunchyroll's brand vibe that they put out, and I'm sure this was intentionally curated just as much as what they're doing now, but it used to be much more fan focused. Like the people that they had at the front at the conventions and things like that felt a little more accessible. Like you saw them in the videos on their YouTube channel and on the podcast. And then it was the same people who would be running the convention panels. So it all sort of felt fandom centered and like you kind of knew the people there. And people might feel this way about some of our review team, even at this point, because of how long you guys have been here. But it just felt a little more goofy, not quite as corporate. And it has become very corporate. And that has led to less trust, I think, to some degree. There were always people who were mean or disliked Crunchyroll as a whole. So like, it's not like everyone loved them and then they got, you know, too big or whatever.
But, well, I mean, but you're like, you have the Right Stuff, you know.
Yes.
Everything that went down with Right Stuff, mm-hmm. where that was another kind of move that felt very hawkish. Right. Or very mercenary and did not necessarily endear the current guard to the community as a whole.
Yeah.
I see people, I think, pretty regularly frustrated about the loss of the original Right Stuff presence, just accessibility and how much that store and that brand just did to make anime feel so much more accessible. This is not like the first time the company has given people reason to go, wait a minute, what are we doing?
Yeah.
I will say now, complete speculation. I know absolutely nothing about what's going on, but having seen similar things happen at a completely non-corporate job, but like one that is very much in a bureaucracy with a lot of moving parts and a lot of moving pieces, I've definitely seen how easy it is for one person with a grudge to just do something kind of shitty and get away with it for a really long time because no one's really paying that much attention.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised if this was genuinely just someone that either doesn't care or there's some bad blood or something.
And
they just, you know, and no one else would know because like, why would they know? Like, what?
They're not. No one else is like monitoring the mail coming into the Texas location. So that was one thing that I had been thinking about is that at least so far, there haven't been any other voice actors that have come forward and been like, yeah, actually, where's my mail too? Right? Because David has written that he hasn't gotten any fan mail since before Skate the Infinity came out.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And
yeah.
The only reason that he knew about this particular package is because the folks that put it together, it was a fan art, fan zine package related to Skate the Infinity. And so they had sent him a picture of everything that was going into it and the tracking number. So he knew that it had arrived and the items weren't there. And it was actually another Crunchyroll employee that was able to find two of the items and return them to him. But he didn't get the entire package. And like, he is understandably tight-lipped about who let him in on the fact that this was happening, but someone told him more details, and that's where he's getting this information about it going back 5 years and whatnot. At least that's the sense that I'm getting from reading the social media posts. But thinking on that, there's still a lot of conjecture about whether this was just absolute disregard and was happening across the board, or, as you said, was some sort of personal issue between one person and Wald and has just been doing this to him for 5 years, which is just like, that scenario is wild to me, but is not outside the realm of possibility given how malicious people can be or petty. So
I mean, it's the entertainment industry, right? Like,
sort of. I mean, I'll be an asshole. It's like kind of... Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that sort of thing attracts certain types of personalities at times.
Yeah. And again, it's not just the entertainment industry. I work in the educational system, and I have seen very similar things happen where, you know, someone gets promoted up the food chain or fails upward high enough, and then all of a sudden other people in the district or in the building start getting treated different. And it's really obvious to everyone what's happening, but no one can do anything because the buck only goes so far. So.
Yeah. As a slight comparison, I had a falling out with someone not related to the anime industry at all, and found out it's been a number of years since, have not communicated with this person, had anything to do with them, that they had built an entire website with and hired an artist to create a comic book with someone who was very obviously based on me. Like, it was like my name, but with the alliteration, but like, it was like Lisa. It was like something like, instead of Lindsay Loveridge, it was like Lindsay
Lockhart,
or Heart Cliff or something that. Right. And then, yes. So, I mean, like, that exists on the internet. I remain completely unsurprised by just how fucking weird people can be about certain grievances, small and otherwise.
What I don't get is really, and I mean, I don't think people think that hard about these kinds of things necessarily, or they just get too comfortable. But like, I wouldn't mess with anyone that has like a following, you know?
I mean, speaking of Wald, like, I don't have like a, you know, to my situation, like, I have 5,000 followers on Twitter is not any, like, it's not like my shit gets caught up in the algorithm and I'm making viral tweets all the time. But someone like David Wald, where people pay money to see him and get his signature on things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also he is friends with a lot of other people that also have followings. So then,
presumably, yeah. For folks who don't listen to a lot of English dubs, you would probably know him as Hans in Attack on Titan and Askeladd in the, I believe it's the Netflix dub of Vinland Saga, because there's two of those. Is it wrong to try to pick up girls in a dungeon? And he is Tetsu in My Hero Academia, which I want to call out just because that character's name is fun to say. Yeah,
which one is that? Do I know them?
Tetsu.
I feel like I would remember that character.
I think Tetsu was one who appeared when School Rival arc, but not the first time that happened. It was like maybe season 4.
Okay, yeah, no.
Yeah, yeah.
I got to Stain, or Stained, or whatever his name is. I got to him. That's as far as I can.
Yeah, okay. That's very early. Yes. Yeah,
I think that's like season 2, so.
Yeah, that's like season 2. So anyway, we'll see how this turns out. David has made some statements on social media that he's planning to continue to blow the whistle on the work environment there, which he is purporting also includes various discrimination based on like sexual orientation, disability, and other like similar things. It's a story to watch right now. Okay, everybody, with the news out of the way, let's talk about, we're going to start with Orb because
a story we can't watch because it's so dark.
Okay. So yes, for those who watched Orb episode 5, it wasn't as bad when I watched it on my PC today, but the episode was really dark for you, right? Let me pull up this is a screenshot James sent to me. See, I don't think anything ever looked this dark for me while I was there. So maybe, you know, dependent on, but can anyone tell us what's going on in this picture? Anybody?
Anybody? The streaming is blurring it a little bit, but this is what I was looking at.
Yeah.
Where freaking Novak looks like a disembodied head just floating like a ghost. And I was watching this, it was not my home computer with the HDR and everything, but I was watching this on the same device that I watched Dandadan again, just to, you know, refresh myself on it.
Yeah.
And it fine. And all of the daytime scenes or whenever the stars came out, that looked fine.
Yeah.
Even later in the episode, when we got more into like the forest with Achi and Gras, it looked better. But the first like 5 minutes of this episode, I genuinely was like, I don't know what the hell's going on. I can't see.
Is this broken? Yeah. For those who don't remember when we left off last week, Gras and Ogzi is how I believe the Japanese dialogue made his name sound, because I listened to it and it sounded like Ogzi. Were escorting a heretic to his death as bodyguards. The heretic started spouting a lot of like, "You dumb believers," yada, yada, yada. It agitated both of them. And then he told them about this chest, right? And that was apparently enough motivation for Gras to be like, you know, I'm just going to put my whole life on the line and screw over the Inquisition, knock the rider off of the wagon. I think maybe he thought that they could make an escape. But it did not work out that way because Nowak was there, and apparently he's a good shot with a crossbow. So he just, the horse, they do a barrel roll, and everyone is, well, the heretic is more or less impaled. And then
Nowak. Well, he saves them. I think he saves Gras, right?
Yes. Because Gras saves Ogzi. And then the heretic saves Gras.
I think so. Novak was going to stab him, and then the heretic says, "I'm passing the torch. Like, it's your job to preserve the truth."
Yes, and I noticed in that moment that the heretic no longer looked like terrifying, old, and scary when he died, which I think was an important moment. Both that maybe some of how he looked was based on Ogzi's perception.
Yeah, and also like you said last time, he's maybe putting on this affect to rattle them. So he's making himself sound and probably just look more intimidating or more twisted than he really was in his final moments.
Yes. But then when he dies, he's at peace, knowing that he passed on the torch, which that's something that Ogzi had brought up in the previous episode, where he was fraught because everyone looked terrified of death whenever he killed them. And so this may be the first person he's seen who seems at peace with his actions and then is just ready to go. And that sends our boys off on a quest. James, what did you think of this episode overall, entertainment value-wise? I thought the animation looked a little weaker.
I didn't really like this episode, to be honest. I thought it was all right. I think for me, if we had maybe one more episode to get to know Gras and maybe understand why he would do something so radical and so dangerous.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I don't buy it. Like, I get that the story is what it is, and that's just who this guy is. He's so determined to find this meaning in the world after that one little retrograde of Mars that he's kind of desperate for answers. And I understand it thematically, but there's just something like the way that he died at the end felt very... like,
bro was not even trying.
No.
Okay. Bro was not even trying because when this was happening, there was a shot, and I was like, he could grab onto some of the bricks there.
Yeah.
And climb his way back up. But he was just done. I think he was just ready.
Yeah. And again, I got that he was depressed, basically, or in despair. But I think doing the torch passing thing twice in such quick succession.
Yeah.
In at least one situation that came across like almost more comical than serious.
Yeah.
It just kind of struck me as like the anime putting the ideas and the philosophy ahead of like the actual plot and the characters.
Yeah.
Which you see sometimes in shows like these. It's almost like the opposite of Monster, where mm-hmm. I love Monster. I think Monster is great. But yeah. there was a stretch in like the last 10 episodes.
Yeah.
Where I was like, we could definitely move this along.
Yeah.
But we really got to discuss these ideas, I guess, which is fine. Mm-hmm. And this is almost the opposite, where it's so ready to get to the next thing.
Yeah.
That it's not even really, it's like, yeah, and then he dies, and now this guy has the book, and now he's going to take it to this guy. And it felt a little...
It's like, we really need to get Augsy to the monk.
Yeah.
How do we get Augsy to the monk? Like, I liked Gross, and I would have liked them almost to be like a trio.
Yeah.
Because you have Augsy, who has no sense of self. He's the most scared murderer I've ever seen in my life. His profession is to kill people, but at the same time, he won't make decisions for himself. He's so frozen in the idea of making the wrong choice or actually thinking about what's important to him and what he feels he should do, that he just lets other people do it for him. And we see that in this episode, because Augsy is planning to go get the chest with all the stuff in it. It's important to him. That's what he wants to do. You know, they do have to lay low no matter what, because, you know, they just abandoned it.
They're fugitives now.
Yeah, they're fugitives. So after they feel that they're clear, because Nowak is convinced they can't read, so it doesn't really matter if they go looking for it. Augsy tells Gross, like, I just realized that I don't really have a reason to come with you. So could you just tell me what to do? Like, he like asks him to tell him what to do, because one part of him definitely knows he should not be doing this because he cares about going to heaven. And everything that just happened is like not heaven behavior.
No.
But on the other hand,
Luce would be very disappointed.
Yes. But on the other hand, he does care about Gross as a human being. I think they've probably worked together for a considerable amount of time. He doesn't want to just abandon him. He feels some responsibility to him. So he just asks Gross to tell him what to do. And Gross is like, well, I'd like the company. And that's like a good enough reason for him to continue on, or to give him an excuse to continue on. So he's like a terrified man. And back to what you were saying, because we haven't spent a lot of time with them, this is our only interpretation of who they are at this point. This is as far as they've grown. I don't understand why Gross trusted him with anything.
Other than the fact that they're just like buds, I guess.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, they're drinking buddies. Like,
as far as it being something as important as, all right, so we've got a wealth of knowledge that is illegal to have and also would upend everyone's perspective on how everything works. And I'm not going to try and climb back up this bridge, even though I could, because I'm just passing the torch to you so I can be at peace with the idea of dying. That's why I feel like, to some extent, he wasn't fully at peace with his discovery. And he just really misses his family and wants to see them in heaven. And this was like an out.
Yes. Well, and what made the first arc so compelling was that Raffle was someone who valued knowledge.
Yeah.
And was so passionate about the genuine beauty and the wonder of the particular science of the heliocentric theory and all that, that it made it compelling for the viewer. And it made like his choice at the end feel very dramatic and feel very interesting.
Yeah.
But here we have two characters, one of whom can't read.
Yes.
Which, again, that's not an insult to him, but like, he genuinely knows nothing about science. His relationship with the stars and with heaven is purely on like an abstract, like metaphorical, theoretical level.
Yeah.
And I guess I could like see how, you know, his character arc can maybe be him like learning these things, but.
Well, learning those things. And I think it's going to end up being something where through knowledge, he's able to overcome his irrational fear of looking at the stars and then be able to experience the world's beauty. That'll happen. Yes.
No, it will.
That'll happen.
But that is such a, like, especially like the being afraid of looking at the stars thing.
Yeah.
That's such an idea thing. That is a character that exists to represent an idea.
Yeah. Right?
Where Raffelfel, even though he also is representing a lot of concepts and positions about valuing truth over conformity and finding the spiritual beauty and like the scientific and all that, Raffel felt like a character that like, you could meet and know and understand. Whereas Agzi feels like a mouthpiece or an allegory. He represents the people who have been so beaten down and frightened by theocracy and irrationality and superstition. And if only he could be freed by the beautiful truth that comes from science.
Yeah.
But he doesn't feel like a real person. Like when he's like cowering and refusing to look at the stars, that's like something you'd see in like a play or, and that's not bad, but it's very different.
Yes.
And then Gras is there who also doesn't really understand what he's looking at when he gets the chest. Like he gets like he's interested, but he doesn't know the math. He doesn't know the science. He's it's more just like, oh, this means something, but then he dies.
Yeah.
And so like that doesn't mean anything to him now. Right.
Yeah.
And so now we have a character that doesn't know what he has or why it's important. And presumably the next couple episodes are going to hopefully be him learning that.
Yeah. Because like you said, he can't read. So I fully agree with you that he is more like a conceptual stand-in for how ignorance breeds fear. And that once he is no longer ignorant of the world, he will no longer be afraid of it. And then we'll, you know, be able to look at the stars again, but he can't interpret any of that information without a very learned person, which in this case will be this monk here.
This guy.
Who's
the most anime looking guy in this entire show.
Yes, he has an eye patch, right? Silver eyes. Long
sexy scars.
Scar over the nose, over the mouth. He may have other ones all over his body from, I don't know, flagellation or something.
Yeah, maybe he's like a flagellant or maybe he's...
Well, what they've told us so far is that he has been demoted recently for having spooky ideas and getting maybe into a fight or something. So he's been demoted within, I don't know if this is the clergy or if there's a different word I should be using other than clergy for this. But anyway.
So. Like it's, you know, the hierarchy of the church.
And so Gras recommended him. And monks in this time period and earlier were usually some of the most educated people. Like they knew how to read and to write. And they were
the scribes.
Like yes, they were the record keepers. They knew mathematics, all these other sorts of things. So he's going to be able to interpret and then speak to Ogsi about this. And I'm sure they want it to be a monk because Ogsi will be more easily swayed by a man of the faith talking to him about these things compared to a layman. Yeah. So I'm sure that's also intentional. But yeah, most of this episode was them finding the chest, thinking about it. And then I also thought the bridge collapsing was kind of silly just because there weren't really any indications of that particular bridge was in disrepair.
It felt contrived.
Gras had to go.
Yeah, it felt very much like with Raffel, that felt like insofar as they could achieve within just a few episodes. It felt like an organic conflict. It made sense.
Yeah.
You bought it. We know that this kind of thing has happened throughout history.
Yeah.
And with this, it feels more like we're just trying to get to the next like philosophical conversation sit down.
Yeah.
Which hopefully will be more visually interesting than two guys just standing in the dark woods looking at books they can barely read.
Yes. Yeah. And again, it's supposed to run for 24 episodes. We have not met most of the characters in the opening sequence. Still don't know who's vomiting. There's some girl that's going to show up eventually. I have read her little character profile. I'm interested for when she shows up because her whole bit is supposed to be that she's gone to learn, but knows that she won't be because she's a woman won't be able to apply her knowledge and is frustrated by having. So there's going to be like, they're going to talk that about that, cool. sort of, that sexism element from that time period. There's just been a bunch of other like one-off characters that have appeared in the OP that we just don't know. So I don't know if this series is going to continue to like switch perspectives, like continue passing torches, so to speak, because this was called Chapter 2 when this episode opened.
Yes, I noticed that.
Everything with Ruffle was Chapter 1, so I don't know how many chapters there's going to be, but I'm kind of curious to see how they do that.
It also doesn't help to kind of segue to our next topic, that we have this episode, which I think visually is very not interesting and flat.
Yeah.
And then we have...
This episode was so good. And this was our first one where we hadn't seen it before, right? No, yes.
Yeah, yeah. This is the first one that, and it's funny because people in the comments of the review even mentioned it's surprising that they didn't end the theatrical movie with this.
Because
that would have
been
perfect. It would have been a perfect little movie.
Yes, yeah, because it wouldn't have been a cliffhanger, it would have been a little conclusion. But maybe if you want people to tune into the TV series and watch the rest, you leave them hanging.
But I mean, can you imagine watching this episode in a theater?
I know, it would be so good, right? Like, okay, so this is mostly a giant chase scene.
Yes.
And one of the things I saw people talking about the most was the use of the William Tell Overture, which my uncultured ass didn't really, like, I recognize the song, obviously, but why that song?
I mean... I don't know that particular remix, if that has any like history. I imagine it was made like for the show. I know that that sequence, someone pointed out that in the manga, that sequence is like a page or two.
Yeah. You know?
Not like it's a good sequence, but it's no more a set piece than anything else in that little fight sequence. And they really took it as an opportunity to just cut loose visually and just play with the art and the choreography. As for the choice of song, I think it's fun. It has a history of being used for high speed chases, races, things like that.
Folks in the comments are saying that it's maybe used in the Lone Ranger.
And that makes sense because Momo's riding him.
Like he's a horse. Yeah.
Yeah, like Silver. So that's pretty good.
Yeah. And that it's used at Japanese high school sports festivals, which would usually have like the relay race that we often see. I also wanted to Heaven or Hell. This isn't to disagree with your comment, but it was very red this episode. And that is an intentional choice. If you read the interview with the director, you can probably expect all the yokai / aliens to have some sort of like color associated with them. With Turbo Granny, it is red. Mm-hmm. With the Serpo aliens, it was blue. With the
sumo guy was black and white.
Black. So that's going to be sort of a recurring thing where we may get an episode that is sort of intensely one color.
And I will say, Heaven or Hell, I don't even disagree with you personally. Mm-hmm. That was like the closest thing that I had to a nitpick with the episode, because, and it's funny you mentioned Undead Unluck, because there were a couple of times in that show where they did that same trick. And I don't know if it's because I'm getting older or what, but that does create a strain on my eyes after a while.
Yeah, it can be like hard to look at.
Playing a virtual boy, you know? But for me, the way that they used the color filter so starkly, like at the end of the episode when when Granny's standing at the edge of the...
Yeah, when they get right to that border and it's just like a clean line down the
I was like, you know what? I'll take it. It's worth it for me.
Yeah. This is mostly anime original in a sense, because this chase scene is not anywhere near as long in the manga. So this was the team at Science Sorrow really getting to play with this whole sequence and make it really exciting. I loved the like point of view shots that we got, it was like Momo's point of view behind Okaroon's head, and just like the flow of the movement where the camera was like you were on a horse. That was really, really fun. I also really liked the improvisation bit at the hot spring, which James, you brought that up in your review, right?
Yeah. Because it was, look, there, I have been developing my taste in like big anime fights. And obviously there's a billion different ways to do it, right? There's no one right way.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking back to some of the fights from Jujutsu Kaisen or Demon Slayer that didn't work for me, even though they were beautifully animated and like excellently choreographed. And I was thinking one of my go-to references for anything action is always Mad Max, any of the Mad Maxes really. But I think something I've really been able to crystallize that I personally love in any like extended action sequence, whether it's a fight or a chase or what have you, are very thoughtful stages where you're able to switch modes and give the audience either a break or a transition or a shift while still escalating the conflict. So like, this isn't just like literally a chase from A to B, right?
Right. Yeah.
We start in the tunnels with Turbo Granny, which is like this claustrophobic, spooky, kind of horror tinged encounter.
Yeah.
Which ends with Okaroon biting Turbo Granny's nipple.
Yes. That is a thing that really happens.
And then it becomes this very Indiana Jones running away from the boulder, Crash Bandicoot monster chase with the crab.
Yes.
That then goes into the hot springs where Momo has the great idea to boil the crab, not because that's a cliche, but because she knows, well, when you boil the crab, its limbs stiffen up because its flesh expands.
Yes.
So they can't outrun it. They have to stop it, which is much more creative than just hitting it really hard or pulling out a new special move for Okaroon for him to just explode it. And even if it is all contrived, but the way they present it makes it feel like, oh yeah, they're thinking on their feet. They're, you know, they're adapting. And then it becomes the big like horde zombie confrontation.
Yeah.
And you have the time limit or what does he call it? His like overdrive where he can only activate it like a couple of times.
Yeah, twice. Yeah.
And so they have to be very conscientious about how they use it, when they use it. Momo's using her spectral arms to slingshot them around. And so then you have this verticality that's introduced in the later section. It's just, it evolves in such a satisfying way that I think is so much more fun than when it's just like two people, you
smashing
know,
smashing against each other action figure style.
There's only so long you can do that, right? But they're like throwing powers at each other that you don't really have context for.
Yeah.
Like for Momo, her arms are still arms. Like they operate like arms. She has to see things. She has to grab things. They're not like infinitely powerful. Okaroon's not infinitely fast. He has a time limit. And he even is limited by the fact that he's carrying Momo.
Yeah.
Like he can't make certain turns because, you know, she's...
And that's why she brings out her hands in the first place, to kind of use them as a pivot. That was another part that I liked. I think that what they did with the camera cinematography, when she grabs, I think it's just like a light pole or something, and they swing around it to make the turn. And it's just very like satisfying the way that it's framed and shot.
Well, momentum is so hard to animate.
Yeah.
It's like one of the key principles of animation, but it's really hard to do. And if any of you go back and watch a decent fight from any show, the key thing that's always missing is momentum. Weight. You don't have that sense of increase and decrease in speed that comes with objects flying through space and encountering opposition and all that stuff, because that's just really freaking hard to do.
Yeah.
But this episode is just filled with it everywhere. Oh my God.
Yeah. They're just, they're nailing it across the board. And then at the end, they throw in this emotional part of it to connect you back to Turbo Granny as a yokai, because after they defeat her in the foot race, Momo's grandma comes in and talks about how she was more like a guardian deity for these girls who were victims of being assaulted and murdered in these dark places by not necessarily the same assailant, but just how certain places attract certain kinds of crime. And so we see all of their spirits float away in a way that seems like they have a release as well. But it puts like new perspective. You brought this up in your review, and it made me think about this a lot. New perspective on just how Turbo Granny had acted throughout that, everything we've seen of her.
Yeah, so in the first episode, right? When she punches through the phone to attack the aliens, where I'm not saying that automatically excuses or like means that people should be okay with how lascivious that bit is when Momo is getting probed. It's so much more thoughtful that the show actually brings that back, and even has Momo and Okaroon like go to her tunnel and pray for her and recognize that the stuff they're going through has weight. It's not just silly, crazy, goofy alien shenanigans.
Yeah.
There's more to it.
Yeah. Putting some emotional context behind why she specifically stole Okoroon's genitals. Mm-hmm. It's still very silly and wild and out there, but I feel like it fits folklore too, where mm-hmm. monsters and stuff do these sort of weird, gross things, but then there's always some sort of cultural tie to it. Mm-hmm. I wish I could remember, for instance, why Kappa eats a spiritual ball-shaped object located in your anus, and that's why you shouldn't go into the water because they'll reach their hand up there and take it and kill you. But, you know, stuff like that. So really, Turbo Granny's bit isn't that unusual if you're a little more familiar with some of the yokai folklore stories. But I did like that. And thinking back on it, in the manga, we do end up getting something sort of like this for all the yokai going forward. It's not always like necessarily like this heavy about crime, but there's always like some sort of logic behind why they are the way they are. And we're going to be encountering quite a few.
And I think that makes sense because this is all over the world, but I'm thinking specifically Japanese folklore. Yeah. So many of those creatures are rooted in trauma or in these strong, violent, intense emotions. I'm thinking of the Nekomata, right?
Okay.
You know, are usually born when there's like a violent death, or at least that's what it was talking about in the yokai show I was watching earlier. Yeah. It's never just as simple as, oh yeah, there's a spooky turbo grin.
Yeah. You know?
And the grudge, right? It's literally a grudge. It's these spirits that are born from these intense things. So it's cool. It's very
cool. If you read the book Ringu that the ring is based on, that's wild, actually. I don't know if I should even like dive.
There's like so many layers to Ringu.
It's not just like it is in the movies, you guys. No, okay? There's like
it's so funny. Honest, not funny.
It's partially related to smallpox or tuberculosis.
Well, so the virus is like literally a virus.
Right.
It's not just like a metaphorical like ghost, you know, haunting virus.
Yeah.
It is very literally a germ. Yeah. That is haunted, that gets inside your body. Mm-hmm. There's also psychic powers and like generational reincarnation. Like,
I believe Sadako is also intersex in the original story.
Yes. And I think in the book, I know that
in
the movie and in a lot of the other adaptations, they nix that detail, but that is a part, I think, of the book. I think the idea is that she's born from like a water spirit, that like her mom was impregnated by like a, I don't know if it's like a demon or what, but there's some sort of like supernatural birth thing happening too.
I just remember that Sadako's psychic, and
Her mom is psychic too.
Mm-hmm. And she gets the germ, which I recall it literally being smallpox, but like she, something to do with her psychicness, like mutates it. Mm-hmm. And then one of the doctors assaults her and throws her in the well.
Yep.
But also,
she stays alive in the well for years.
I think she passes the virus on to the doctor. What I don't remember is how the virus is spread via videotape.
There's some explanation.
Yeah.
And that doesn't even get into the fact that I'm pretty sure, based on at least some of the videos and stuff I've watched, that one of the later books reveals that the entire Ringu saga is actually taking place in virtual reality.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes me mad.
Yeah.
This is Koji Suzuki who wrote the books, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to write him a letter. I only ever read the first book, so I didn't read anything beyond that because the American adaptation of the film like scared the crap out of me.
Oh, that movie's so good. I watched it not too long ago with my wife because she'd never seen it.
Yeah.
Holds up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It truly does. So that brings us to the end of our little chat here on Dandadan and Orb and what's going on in the
anime. Wait, no. We can't finish Dandadan yet.
Oh, right.
We didn't cover the greatest moment of the episode, Lindsay.
Are you talking about this one?
This entire sequence?
The entire sequence where everyone is gorging on crab.
And making the funniest goddamn
noise. What is going on? Okay, yes. So Momo is just like chowing down on these crab legs. Now, I'm a person who I like a good crab leg. Crab legs are delicious. I don't know if there's anything I've made this face while eating, except for maybe the one time that I had Korean barbecue in Japan earlier this year, because that I did almost cry while eating that meat. It was the most delicious meat I'd ever eaten in my entire life. But other than that, I can't recall anything tasting this good. Maybe the
I'm
best.
I'm not gonna lie. Yeah. I went on an Alaskan cruise once, and we stopped off for like 6 hours at one of the ports. I can't remember where, but like right offshore, there was a place that's like famous for its crab legs. You literally ordered just a bucket of crab legs. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, $150 or something, but they like pull the crabs like right out of the water, right by the port. And I legitimately, that was maybe 6 years ago, maybe more. It's probably more than 6 years ago now. I think about those crabs on like a weekly basis, at least once.
That's the exact same way I am with what I think was the Kobe beef that we wasn't doing anything to that other than putting it on the grill at our table.
That's all you need.
And then eating it, and it tasted like butter, and it melted in my mouth. And I was like, I had thought up to that point, people were just over dramatic. Like, I was like, oh, I've had Kobe beef. Like, this isn't, but for some reason... Yeah. It was just like a whole nother level. So yeah, everyone in the chat, I guess the question is, what food makes you look like
Momo? What food makes you make a Momo face?
Yeah, what food makes you make a Momo face? You can let us know. Here's another Momo face if you need more inspiration.
Yeah, we've all been there.
Yeah, yeah. But also, okay, I guess while people put it in the chat, I thought their goodbye was so cute because they say sayonara at first, which is
wait, that's not right.
Because sayonara is a more like, I'm not going to be seeing you for a while. So like it implies that
it's much less personal, right?
Yeah.
There's no like social obligation. There's no, you know.
Yeah. It kind of implied that, okay, well now that this is over, you know, we won't be hanging out at school. It was kind of the unspoken part of it. And they were both thinking about that. And then Momo tells them, see you later, and like corrects it. And
his face gets all red.
It is so cute.
And the sounds that I made when I watched that.
Yeah.
Just punch dancing my feelings.
Okay, here's chat's food that makes them make a Momo face. Uh-huh. Vice696 says birria, which I think I had that for the first time at a food truck the other day. So
okay.
Fully understand. Pui Pui Molsa says ribeye. Lee Bug says Haagen-Dazs pralines and cream ice cream. That is really good.
Yeah, it is.
Mr.
Yeah,
A, fresh baked bread. Yes, mm-hmm. Especially sourdough. I love sourdough bread.
God, I worked at Panera for a couple of years, and
the
sourdough I ate.
Me and carbs are best friends. Yeah. So, Yon says Korean barbecue, which
nice.
Yes,
good choice.
Quanti 5 says that's some overcooked crab if it's that tough. Heaven or Hell. Okay. Heaven or Hell says a strawberry smoothie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I have such a penchant for like artificial strawberry flavor.
Yeah.
The gas station right across the street from my house sells those Hello Pandas, the strawberry flavored ones. It's really bad for me.
Laffy Taffy. Yeah. Is a close second. The only thing I put above it is banana Laffy Taffy, artificial banana Laffy Taffy flavor. It's just,
I love artificial banana anything.
Yeah.
When I found out that flavor is just the flavor that bananas used to have before they all died out, I was so mad.
What have we done? We have ruined the banana.
Yeah. Well, you can still get them. They're just ridiculously expensive.
Never seen them at any of like my local places now.
No. You have to like order them from an island. Like they're not getting shipped because they're not mass market enough. You can't grow them in huge batches anymore because we killed them.
I feel like there would be a demand. Why isn't anyone?
They die really easily. They don't last long.
Okay. They're like very sensitive.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it. That's probably why they're so expensive. H Field says a good ass steak.
Yeah.
You gotta tell me what cut of steak, because they're not all equal. You know, like a New York strip and a ribeye in it. You
know, Lindsay's over here just rubbing her Kobe beef experience in her face. It's just like, you know, guys, there are certain kinds of steak that are just going to be inherently more life-changing than all the rest. I'm not going to specify what, but just so you know, that does exist.
It does exist. Let's see. James B just says cheeseburger and basic cheeseburger from where?
Yeah, don't be giving me any of that, oh God, what's the California one?
In-N-Out?
Yeah, don't be giving me any of that In-N-Out, okay?
I'll go ahead and say I tried In-N-Out for the first time with a friend. I got the animal, which is just when they put everything on it. I guess the thing with In-N-Out is that it's never bad.
Sure, but like, okay, let's be honest, everyone. When is a fast food burger truly bad? I say that even though my state is currently going through a McDonald's E. coli crisis. So
that would be win.
That's a bad one.
That would be win. My favorite burger is I don't know how widespread this chain is, but it's called Killer Burger. Mm. It's overpriced, but really good. It's kind of the closest you can get to a fast steakhouse kind of burger. My favorite is the peanut butter pickle burger. It has both.
Peanut butter on burgers is so good.
Peanut butter on burgers is so good. I'm glad that we agree on this.
There's Crave Burger is a joint here. They do like the big crazy burgers.
Yeah.
But they have just like a PB&J burger that is.
Oh, yeah.
And it has candied bacon. It's so I can only eat it once a year because otherwise I will have a heart attack. That once a year I get to eat it is a great time.
I have told myself that it's okay for me to get the peanut butter pickle burger if I get the kid size version of it, so the patty is smaller, and I'm like, that's fine. Then it's okay.
That's fine.
I've compromised, so I can eat more of these.
It's like how when I get a quarter pounder or a Big Mac, but then I don't get the fries.
Yeah. Okay. I also do that.
Yeah, that's okay.
It's like I'll have a water instead of a soda, and I won't get any fries. This is fine now.
Right. And then Heaven or Hell, to answer your question, Five Guys is great if you just need something greasy and salty and just filled with juicy burger.
Don't their fries suck, though?
Oh, the fries are good.
The fries are good.
They don't keep.
They don't keep.
They don't keep. No, they get real mushy, but they have like a nice kind of Cajun sort of seasoning on them. Yeah.
They do more like a steak fry than like a French fry, right?
They're like they're almost like halfway between an Arby's curly fry and just like a steak fry.
What's your opinion on Arby's?
Oh, I love Arby's. I think Arby's gets a bad rap.
I think they do too. Thanks, John Stewart. Like I like an Arby melt. Like it's just
They had a pork belly burger where they would put like a little slap of pork belly on there. I'm not even going to pretend to know what the hell that pork belly was because it sure as hell wasn't. You know, 5-star Michelin quality for the price he was paying.
Yeah.
But hot damn. It's probably the best fast food, like drive-through burger that I've had.
Wow.
It was great.
Wow.
It was great.
Wow. Well, James, I feel like there are so many things we could have podcasts about outside of just anime. Like we could have a fast food podcast.
We could.
We could have a horror movie podcast.
We could and should.
Diversify and create our podcast empire, James and I, right?
Yeah. Like, I mean, if we do J horror, we could keep it within the.
Yeah. Horror. Yeah. Or we could call it something clever, like, I don't know. I was trying to think of a horror word that kind of rhymed with fries or started with, like fries and frights. And then we're just talking about.
You see, my first instinct went to like fries and yowies.
Yowies? Like yowie? But yeah, sang it like a valley girl and yowies.
Yowies.
Fries and yowies. No. then we combine both the fast food and the horror anyway. I'm going to spend the rest of the day just saying that. All right, you guys, thanks for sticking around with us and getting ready for the podcast with me this evening. It was great talking to you all, and we'll see you next week with more Dunedin and more Orb. Mm-hmm. Bye!
The ANN After Show is an official podcast of Anime News Network. You can hang out with us live on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern on YouTube and Twitter. Listen to our podcast on Spotify or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. The ANN After Show is hosted by Lindsay Loveridge and James Beckett and is produced by Lindsay Loveridge.